Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft, heute mit einer Oxium-Sendung zu einer Konferenz, die in Prag stattgefunden hat, ein Kolloquium zur Philosophie und so und Social Science, also Sozialwissenschaft. Und beginnen wollte ich mit einer Session, die das Thema Recognition, also Anerkennung hatte. Und zwar hat dort Arthur Leighton vorgetragen über Esteem as a Type of Recognition. Geplant war das erst mit Heikki Ikähemo zusammen, aber dieser war leider nicht da. Und ich spiele jetzt erst die Diskussion und über dieses Thema Esteem as a Type of Recognition und auch den Vortrag von Arthur. Und dann gibt es noch ein Interview mit Arthur Leighton gleich. So, also bis gleich.
I had to cancel, so I restructure my paper slightly. Okay, so our intention was to give two takes on esteem as a type of recognition. And the two takes was that there are two rival views on recognition and two rival views of esteem. And I'm not going to focus on that, but I'll just mention them to begin with. One view on recognition says that to recognize is to take or treat the other as a person. The second view is that to recognize someone is to take the other as someone who counts, as a possessor of normatively relevant features, whether or not these features are ones had only by persons. So that this is, conceptually there's a huge difference, in practice almost no difference at all. But that's the, I mean, two rival definitions of what it is to recognize. And then two rival takes on what esteem as opposed to respect, care, and other possible forms of recognition is. That one view is that esteem is some kind of feedback concerning contributions to the good of others, or contributions to the common good. This is roughly the Honnethian picture in the Struggle for Recognition book. And on a broader view, esteem is feedback concerning any merits or valuable particularities, so that it need not be precisely for contributions to the common good, but anything worth valuing or anything worth holding in esteem. And the test can be taken that if feedback from others is sort of relevantly connected to my self-esteem, then that kind of feedback is esteem. But of course, I mean, there's esteem in the self-esteem, so that's putting something before something. Okay, so, but let me proceed differently. I won't go to the details of that sort of pros and cons of these different conceptual distinctions, but I will mention four different kinds of cases related to esteem and ask how a good society would arrange things concerning these four kinds of cases. And implicitly, this is an argument for the broader definition of esteem, in that I think that these are all cases of esteem in a meaningful sense. But I mean, that's not the main point. And I should say that I was prepared to give the conceptual talk, so this is quite unprepared, and this is sort of just leftover ideas that will not be included in the paper, but something that will benefit me in the future. Okay, so the idea is that human agents have a need to have a positive relation to self, including self-esteem, and these relations are deeply dependent on the recognition from other individuals and institutions, such as the state. So, for example, stigmatizing practices may lead to an internalized sense of inferiority and low self-esteem. So the basic idea is that a good society is sensitive to the dynamics of self-relations and recognition. So that's the basic Honnethian and Hegelian idea. And for example, the invisible housework by women should get due recognition, and welfare services should not be delivered in a stigmatizing or demeaning fashion, and so on. Now, there is something in the spirit of esteem that is egalitarian, so that no one should be treated as inferior, treated in a demeaning fashion as a second-class citizen, or a priori incompetent or something. But then there's a twist. Unlike basic respect or unlike concern for others' basic needs, the grammar or logic of esteem seems to be conditional on one's merits, achievements, or other positive particular features. And so esteem has to be deserved or grounded in one's valuable particular features. One must be worthy of esteem. And if granting esteem is to differ from mere lip service, then granting esteem is based on judgment concerning these particular features. And this, this at least is Charles Taylor's view on what recognition in general is, and particularly esteem is. Now, especially when cultural differences are involved, such judgments may be difficult to form and may take a lot of time and effort. You know, coming to learn other cultures may take years. So that was just in terms of introduction to the theme of the paper. So I would like to point out three challenges to any politics of esteem and then discuss these three challenges in the four different kinds of cases. So the first challenge is meritocracy versus egalitarianism. So perhaps politics of esteem leads to a wrong kind of meritocracy, some kind of Nietzschean vision of power of the noble, and undermines modern egalitarianism. So the defenders of basic equality and basic respect will have to tell what kinds of social and political arrangements would both respond to the need for differential esteem and be compatible with this kind of egalitarian ethos of mutual respect and basic care. So it should not lead to the formation of second-class and first-class citizens. So that's the tension between meritocracy and the kind of egalitarian ethos which I take for granted in this paper and in life in general. Okay, but mere lack of disesteem, so that if we remove all stigmatizing stereotypes and so on, doesn't meet the need for differential esteem. So presumably there is a need for genuine esteem. And if such genuine esteem is difficult and takes time and energy, then the question is, whose is anyone's, if anyone's duty, is it to give these what Pettit and Brennan called esteem services? So that who should, whose task is it? I mean, it takes time and energy, so. So just to give a humdrum example, I may be pretty confident that a book by a colleague is brilliant, but I will need to read it properly before I can publish a review, and that will take time and energy and so on. So perhaps there's no duty for me to do it. Perhaps there's only a negative duty not to disesteem a priori, say that this author is of such and such ethnicity, gender, age, and so on, so I don't even need to read the book. It is obviously rubbish. So that's, there's a negative duty not to have that kind of a priori stigmatization. Plus there's an a posteriori duty, if you like, that if one engages in this esteem service, one does it in an unbiased manner. And possibly there may be extra positive duty to take a sufficient number of these esteem services so that everyone should write a decent number of reviews and decent number of journal referees, you know, in their duty as an academic and so on. So that's the second issue, burdens of positive efforts. So whose task is it? And as a flip side of this second is that it can be asked in terms of permissions. Who is entitled to stick their nose in my business and form an opinion on my esteem worthiness? Is it a proper business of the state, for example? And while it's okay for all of you to, you know, judge my conference talk as half-baked and, you know, express it and say it aloud, and I shouldn't take that as, you know, as improper, is it okay to people to judge my, you know, general orientation in life in the same way and then come and tell me that, okay, but the way you live your life is just absolute rubbish, and, you know. So is there even a permission to, or, I mean, is there a problem on who can say what to whom in terms of esteem? Okay, and the third problem is just a conceptual problem. So the first one, this was this meritocracy worry, and the second is that whose task is it, and then the third worry is just conceptually that are these cases really cases of esteem at all, or first and foremost cases of esteem? So here are the four cases. All of these have been already mentioned in the introduction so far. So the four cases, the first is the negative case against stereotypical stigmatizing, kind of freedom from a priori disesteem. And it can be said that everyone has this kind of very basic need not to be subjected to this kind of treatment. And this is, I think, strictly egalitarian, that everyone has a full right to full freedom from unfounded disesteem. The second case is positive esteem based on contributions to the societal good, perhaps related to a division of labor and what Durkheim called organic solidarity. So that in a good society, ideally good society, no one is unemployed or excluded from making useful contributions to the common good. But rather in a complementary manner, everyone has a sort of general positive status or rank with role expectations that they contribute to the common good. So that's the general kind of case, which I think is primarily discussed by Honneth in The Struggle for Recognition. And the first one, this kind of against stereotypical stigmatizing, is being discussed by various authors. Now, concerning this second case, I would go so far as to reverse the Kantian dictum that always treat others, never treat others merely as means, but always also as ends. I would say that that's good, but it can also be reversed. Never treat others merely as ends, but also as positive, as possible means to the common good. So that, for example, disabled people should get a chance to feel themselves needed and as potential contributors to the common good. So this is still quite egalitarian, so it's sort of against hierarchies of overall ranks or statuses that everyone should be included and have this sort of general status as positive contributor to the common good. The third kind of case concerns personalized differential feedback concerning merits and achievements in the context of individual self-realization in various kinds of projects in which people try to excel, try to do a good job. And these may or may not be related to the societal good, but they may be just, you know, hobbies or whatever. Arguably, this is a deeply dialogical business, and esteem plays a role here. So this is related to the Hegelian idea that self-realization requires deeds, and one cannot assume to be the privileged authority in the unbiased evaluation of such deeds. That evaluation is public, and there's always some kind of relevant audience. And without any sort of friction provided by the feedback from others, we all could be victims of illusory sense of self-grandeur, that we could be great poets in our own self-image, whether or not we bother to realize our great ideas and actually to write the poems at all, and subject them to evaluation of others. There's this nice quote, let's see if I can get to read it, from Hegel's Phenomenology, where he makes fun of the romantic ideals of self-realization, which sort of neglect this idea that they should also realize their ideas. Okay, and then the final fourth case concerns positive esteem for cultural groups understood as ways of life. This is the kind of Charles Taylor question. Now, many commentators to Taylor have pointed out that recognition of cultural differences, perhaps first and foremost, is not a matter of esteem or judging the merits of the cultures, but rather a matter of respecting the individuals and their cultural conditions for satisfactory life. And I think that's right, that not everything related to cultural differences is a matter of esteem. But nonetheless, I think that in principle, there can be this kind of feedback from others, and in principle, that can affect your self-esteem. So that I think that that's one possible context for esteem, and then good society takes some stand on how these things happen. Okay, so how am I doing with time? I mean, merely introducing this idea that there are these four cases of esteem, and the idea that these four cases answer differently to the three challenges, so that they are differently egalitarian, and they have different distributions of duties and permissions. So that's the main point. And then we can sort of collectively try to figure out what would be the best answer. I'll give the second best answers, if you allow me. Okay, so the first case is pretty clear. I mean, this idea of against stereotypical stigmatizing, no one should be... There's basically no trait is an excuse for second-order citizenship. So there's the negative duty. You shouldn't, you know, buy into these stereotypes yourself. But then what is more interesting is in this division or distribution of duties is that I would claim that it's everyone's business in the moral community to prevent anyone other from stigmatizing anyone else. So that here everyone is permitted to stick their nose to, I mean, that... Everyone can disturb a racist who has these kinds of attitudes, and everyone has a positive duty to do their share in combating racism. Now, I also ran out of battery, but maybe that's for the better. That's better for the eye contact. Anyway, so the second case is the contributions to the societal good, and there my basic idea was that this idea of division of labor is still a very viable one. I mean, it might be for sociological reasons that it's very hard to realize that there are no real chances of full employment and so on. But nonetheless, I mean, it's a good ideal for how in good society things would get arranged. And in distinction to the individualized context of self-realization, I think that we can say that we could speak about general rank or status, so that everyone has this general rank who contributes, who is in a role, in a societal role, with role expectations to contribute to the societal good. No matter how well or badly they actually perform in this role, but one important thing is that everyone has this kind of backbone, that at least they occupy this kind of useful role. And this is still a very egalitarian idea, that it's very important for important layer of esteem or self-esteem, if you wish, to occupy a in principle useful role. I mean, you don't need to be useful, I mean, actually good in your role, but it's important that you have the role. And this is related to two different salary systems, which in Finnish university we just moved from one salary system to another. We used to have this status or role expectation based salary system, but then we've moved to this kind of individual achievement based salary system. And I think that the former is much more solidaristic, and it's a better society where salaries are based on role expectations which are roughly equal, so that we need professors and we need, you know, cleaning personnel, and, you know, both contribute to the common good, and, you know, both are esteemed, and both should get very high basic salary, so that the differentials then could be more immaterial, like, you know, some other kinds of rewards, and so we could, you know, distinguish monetary rewards from other kinds of rewards, like in, you know, university systems, being the plenary speaker of a great conference is, you know, great, whatever, I mean, whether you get paid for it or not, so that, you know, that there are other kinds of rewards than money. Which gets me to the third context, that we still need this for our self-image. We do need also feedback concerning how well we are doing, and that's then the third context for self-esteem, so that a good society would, on top of these, have these what I call pockets of esteem or pockets of competitive arenas where everyone could have, you know, which would be outlets for this, what Francis Fukuyama calls megalothymic drives of people's. I mean, people have this want to, you know, be good and want to excel and so on. And it would be good that a society has pockets of esteem for this. For example, the scientific community has many sort of sub-pockets, and the art world, the sports, and so on. So that these would be related to the self-esteem, and no need for here that the contribution is especially contributes to the common good or so, but you meet the standards for evaluation in this particular pocket. And what is important is that this doesn't generalize into a general status, so that, I mean, even if you're a great poet, you don't get to be the first in line in a post office. So that it's really restricted only in the pocket, and in this sort of in the social world in general, everyone would have the same status. Everyone would have the basic status not being denigrated, and the positive status of occupying a role with positive role expectations, being in a useful job. And then on top of that, everyone would have their individual record of, you know, the kind of stuff that you put in your CV and so on. So here I would have read the Hegel quote, but I mean, I don't bother turning my computer on, so the fourth context then is the cultural differences, or the kind of esteem concerning cultures as whole. And let's see, I mean, here I don't have a clear view on what a good society would do. I think that there's a great theoretical difficulty in, first of all, trying to figure out whether it even makes sense, because cultures partly consist of standards of evaluation. Then comparing cultures is kind of meta question, that whether that's even conceptually possible. And I mean, as a promissory note, I would say that I think that it's conceptually possible, but it's extremely difficult. And then the question is there any point to that kind of comparison? And then there might be, here's one sort of very tentative idea, let's see how this goes. It might be related to what Durkheim called this kind of mechanical solidarity, this sort of sense of belongingness, that it's good that you can be proud of your own way of life. And then, I mean, it's not enough that only you and your pals think that, okay, our way of life is great, but it's also good that you get some confirmation for that from outside. So that seems to be that there's a point to it. But then, I think that, I mean, there are a lot of questions on how exactly is this done or what is at stake, which is sort of very unclear to me in practice. Okay, but I think I'll just stop here.
Thank you very much. So we've got about 15 minutes. Much for discussion. I had a question about the fourth context that you mentioned, and you said that you have some trouble figuring out the place for cultural differences, and since you based your account on both Taylor and Poneth, I was just wondering if you cannot take something from Taylor's product of recognition. It's, I think it's towards the end when he discusses the question of using hyperbolic ways of fusing horizons and understanding the standpoint of others in terms of what role the goods that they have, that they cherish, as well as self-realization to actually figure out how to deal with this kind of cultural dependence or specific kind of differences. But, I mean, for instance, I mean, the conflict of discussion, if I remember correctly, was about whether the Zulus released their posters.
Yeah.
Right. So the question was not whether the Zulus, but whether we can find the independent separate standards that would, to some extent, provide evaluations of the two cultures in case of, say, Russian and Zulu culture. But whether they fulfill a specific role, cultural productions of those two different cultures, to a specific role that could be tied to the way in which individuals can have a chance for self-realization of the culture. So in that sense, there is no need to actually find independent standards of judging whether some cultural production is.
Right. Okay.
I
totally agree with that. So that, and I should say that I'm a great fan of Charles Taylor's work, and I think that this idea of fusion of horizons, and that's that as a kind of answer to how practical reason can function in comparison of cultures, I think that, I mean, to put it this way, I buy that story, so that I think that that's in essence the right answer to give. So that in that sense independent standards is kind of misleading, but then what Taylor calls the language of perspicuous contrast, or that there's this kind of, I mean, neither of these original horizons or cultures, but then there's this emerging third one. So that there, I mean, we're judging by the standards of that culture then, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so,
the goods or hyper-goods, again, to use that terminology. He mentioned at some point, maybe a weak cultural progress that would put us in a position to actually see whether certain goods or certain values that a society cherishes that is undermined over a period of time, and so forth. Could that also be somehow included in your conflict?
Right. I somehow find it curious that, I mean, that what kind of question is being asked by Honneth and what kind of answer is given by Honneth. That criteria for progress, in a sense, I mean, to put it this way, in any area of life that we are thinking of, things can be arranged better or worse. So that's what progress is. I mean, movement from the worse to the better.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gives these two substantive criteria, like individualization and inclusion and so on. And these are two substantive things. I mean, so that they are not meta criteria for every area, but they are two areas themselves. So the thing, there can be progress concerning individualization and concerning inclusion, but also progress concerning other things. And what is progress in these other things is depends on what the thing is in question, but by hypothesis, it's not either of these two. So that I don't think I think that it's the wrong kind of answer to that question.
Mario? I appreciate your contribution. It was great, I think. I just wonder how you differentiate that egalitarianism versus meritocracy when you mentioned those three challenges concerning the politics of esteem. I understand what you want to say, basically, but still I think that it should be analyzed more in detail in a way that even earlier discussions on the politics of esteem, or let me say the politics of recognition, are a bit more complicated. If you look at Taylor's The Politics of Recognition, you can see that he talks about the politics of universalism and the politics of difference.
Right.
And of course you can say that the first one is about equality and the second about difference, but it's more complicated because even Taylor admits, and especially Michael Walzer's interpretation of his paper, says that both are about equality. The first one, the politics of universalism, treats equally all the citizens, and the second treats equally various cultural groups. So the second treats equally all the differences. So there is a difference and equality at the same time. So I think that you should analyze this point as well, because there is equality as well in treating those differences. So
yeah, I think that's fundamentally right, in that a kind of unequal way of proceeding concerning merits would be that, okay, you know, he's my brother, you know, so he's in the top league, and so that would be unequal in the sense that you put your near and dear, sort of, you use double standards in that sense, so that equality requires that no double standards are being used. So in that sense, that's true. And I should, I didn't mention that I take this problem from Taylor and Honneth, that they both sort of acknowledge that, okay, there is this universalistic thing, and then there is this more, I don't know, particularistic thing, and so on. But how I differ from them is with the suggestion that there are these four different contexts in which the, I don't know, kind of strict egalitarianism of one size fits all versus then the particularity or difference sensitive kind of egalitarianism, that there are also relevant differences, that in these four different contexts these two things play out differently, and also especially the distribution of duties of whose business is it anyway gets played out differently. But I totally agree with your comment.
Ja, bevor ich jetzt das Interview mit Arthur Leytinen spiele, noch ein paar Informationen. Er ist Dozent für Philosophie am Department of Social Science and Philosophy an der University of Jyväskylä in Finland. Und seine Research Questions are: they concern the nature of mutual recognition and its internal relation to normativity and social solidarity. Also Arthur's research hypothesis is that recognizing in mutual recognition is to be understood as adequate regard concerning others or as adequate responsiveness to their normatively relevant features. Thus, it differs from mere identification of something as something. It concerns persons and other concrete individuals and thus differs from recognition of values and principles as valid. Und ja, ein paar seiner Veröffentlichungen sind zum Beispiel zum Bedeutungsspektrum des Begriffs Anerkennung, die Rolle von adäquater Würdigung und Gegenseitigkeit in Hans-Christoph Schmidt am Busch und Christopher Zurn, Anerkennung in der deutschen Zeitschrift für Philosophie, Sonderband. On the Scope of Recognition, the Role of Adequate Regard. Ah, das ist der englische Text. Und dann noch The Role of Personifying Attitudes and Instrumental Value in the Plural States of Recognition. Und neu ist auch Taylor on Solidarity, Hegel and Action, Recognition and Social Ontology. So, und jetzt kommen wir zum Interview.
How did you become, or could you remember the time when you became interested in philosophy and especially in recognition theory?
I remember how I got interested in philosophy in general, and that was related to the kind of general ecological worry, and then some books in Finnish that I read where the challenge was posed that this calls for thinking, that we really need to think through the all the principles that we live by and the whole Western way of life. So that was the kind of context when I got interested in thinking, and then I thought that, well, maybe in philosophy departments that's the thing that they do, and it turned out that it was not quite what I had expected it to be, but then it sort of has kept me doing philosophy ever since.
Yeah, so you start to study philosophy in
Jyväskylä. Jyväskylä, yeah.
Yeah,
that was 1990, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, Hegel is very strong in Finland. So, But you started very early to work on recognition theory with scholars together.
Right. There was the teacher who was sort of most interesting from my perspective, and my close friends agreed with that, was actually finishing a PhD at that time, and that was on Hegel's Jena writings, and the topic of recognition was very, very relevant then. And I think that Axel Honneth's struggle for recognition appeared, I think, the previous year before this PhD thesis was written. So that's, I suppose, that he, in his lectures on Hegel's Jena philosophy, referred to Honneth's work, and this idea of recognition was very central from then onwards. So as an undergraduate student, I sort of felt that that's the basic approach to philosophy. And we had these reading groups on Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, which was just extremely difficult to understand, and I'm not sure if we understood much, but it was really fascinating stuff to read.
Was it in German or in Finnish?
It hasn't been translated fully into Finnish, only some chapters of it, but we read it in English at that time. Some people read it in German, so that there was this also constant struggle for understanding, and some people sort of told that how the German text goes and how bad the English translation was at points and so on. But that was, I suppose that what got me interested in thinking was this sort of general ecological worry, but what got me interested in philosophy was basically Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. So that might be it. So recognition is, of course, very central.
Yesterday,
in your talk about esteem and in recognition. Sorry, I didn't. No. Esteem as a type of recognition. Esteem is this respect and love part of what Honneth calls recognition in relation to, in a psychological way somehow. So why do you figure something out of this concept, esteem as a specific type of recognition?
Yeah, this is part of an ongoing project with my close colleague Heikki Ikäheimo to just come up with, I suppose, ultimately a theory of recognition. And this is part of, and as a part of that project, we have tried to understand that what exactly is esteem and how does it differ from other types of recognition. And our idea was to give a talk, sort of two rival interpretations on what it might be, but then as it happened that Heikki couldn't make it here, then I decided to focus less on the definition of esteem, but then give sort of examples of different contexts in which esteem seems to make a difference.
Yeah, and these examples were, for example, and that was an interesting question, I don't know.
This question was with the book of a friend. If you would estimate the book, if you know somehow if the book is, if you like to read the book or not, if you have read two or three books which were bad and so on. And so,
is it more a critique on the academic philosophy also?
Not really. I think that was just, the question sort of arises from the general observation that
recognition as such is sort of, there's a drive towards egalitarianism, so that all people are equal and we owe mutual respect towards everyone. But then there's something in the logic of esteem, which is that genuine esteem seems to be responsive to different particular features that people have, so that people are different in relevant ways, so that it seems that we cannot simply, and esteem has to be, you have to be worthy of esteem before you can really get genuine esteem. And just as an example, and one problem with this is that genuine esteem may be very laborious, that it may take a lot of effort and time and energy to do it. And just as an example for that, I just gave this very humdrum example that before you can evaluate a book, you must read the book, so that whatever a priori conceptions you would have about the book, you can't really tell.
Or about the person who wrote the book?
Yeah, I mean, one kind of strong kind of stereotype would be that, okay, you don't even need to read a book, because if you know that, you know, it was written by someone who belongs such and such ethnic group or such and such gender or, I don't know, whatever particularities you pick up, that you wouldn't even have to read the book, that you know already that it's obviously going to be rubbish because it's written by such and such person. So that would be a wrong kind of stigmatizing or stereotyping, that you wouldn't even give it a chance. So that was one part of it. And then another part of it is that you really should judge the book by its merits, and not, for example, by whether you know the person or it happens to be your brother or something like that. So
yeah. And you have talked also about pockets of esteem. So in which way are pockets of esteem good?
For society.
Right. The pockets of esteem is just a metaphor for the general idea that, unlike in pre-modern societies where it was okay that people are of different general ranks, that there are sort of first-class citizens and second-class citizens and so on, any legitimate order of esteem must restrict the differential esteem to this sort of within certain kind of pocket, so that if someone is a good pianist, you should esteem him or her for these skills and performances, but that wouldn't give him any legitimate overall status to, you know, be the first in post office in the lines, or, you know, get discount for cars or anything like that. So that there are sort of strict limits, so that this kind of differential esteem is compatible with egalitarianism only if it's limited to within these pockets. So that's the idea.
Yeah.
And that's just, I mean, I don't know if it's a good word for that, but I think the idea is good.
Yeah, that's right. And for example, if you are in a specific group and you want to become you want to have friendship with some people in a specific group, which could be also a pocket of esteem or only a pocket, and and it could be that because of you want to become friend of someone else who doesn't want to become friend of you, that you are not recognizing that others like to have friendship with you and so on. And how is this, how would you, is there then still a kind of hierarchical or something else, a kind of structure in this pocket?
Right. I think there's an important difference that I would like to draw between these so-called pockets of esteem and then circles of friends, if you like, that they follow a different basic principles or basic logic or grammar, if you wish, in that in a circle of friends, people are not replaceable, that they are, even if you would get a perfect copy of your friend, it wouldn't be the same, because you want it to be your friend, so that people, it matters the sort of that which person is in question, and not just the qualities. Whereas then, when it comes to esteem, you should be behind perhaps a veil of ignorance, that you should only pay attention to the qualities, and in that sense think of the bearer of the qualities as replaceable, so that whoever, that's the kind of idea, for example, in academic blind review, that you read the text without knowing whose text it is.
Yeah.
So that's, and so the logic of esteem is in that sense indifferent to which person is in question, and what matters is that what kind of qualities or what kind of esteem worthiness is at stake.
Yeah.
So that in that sense just evaluation is blind, but
yeah.
Then friendship of course shouldn't be blind. I mean, that's what friendship is, that it's an attachment between concrete individuals, and that's precisely what matters. So that in that sense circles of friends and pockets of esteem are sort of totally different things.
All right. But then if pockets of esteem are something else than friends, how is that relation when the friends are at the same time professionals, profession in the same profession?
Is that they are then in a pocket somehow?
Right, and that's... then we have to distinguish between, so to speak, different layers in the relationship between two concrete persons. I mean, I would say that the core layer is formed by mutual respect, or ideally mutual respect, that they should respect each other, and you know, normally do respect each other to a significant extent, and consider each other as equal and autonomous persons, and listen to each other's judgments and so on. So that's one layer in there, and the logic of respect in that sense is sort of more universalistic than either esteem or friendship or love. And then it can be, of course, that two people, I mean, in their concrete relationships, there are all sorts of layers, so that they can be friends and they can be colleagues and they can be just autonomous persons and so on.
Yeah.
And the idea is simply that you should take all of this into account in your dealings, and that sometimes there are cases where you should ignore the fact that someone is your friend, and in other cases that's not necessary. And often, for example, it's a good thing that colleagues or people who work together also, you know, like each other, or that they become friends. I mean, of course, it's naturally a good thing for their lives, and so it's better than that they would dislike each other. But that's but I think that people are sort of automatically or intuitively very sensitive to all sorts of nuances, so the complexity of the picture is no problem for the theory, but it's just something that we should expect, because life is complex.
Yeah, in which way are you interested in sociology? Because what you are saying about pockets of esteem, or how friendship could be evaluated, it's different from how sociologists would describe the relations between different groups, for example. So what's your interest?
I don't have really training in sociology, so I'm at most an amateur in sociology, but I'm very interested in various kinds of takes on the issues, and I'm interested in what keeps societies together, or what is the social glue, and so on. So I'm very interested in those kinds of theories, and actually I think that it can be claimed that recognition is an important part of what keeps societies together. So that I think that this is at the same time of sociological importance, or importance for social theory.
Also, if recognition is failing, and in some parts you have more misrecognition than recognition.
Yeah.
Then what you have is more a kind of moral view on how the recognition could be better, yeah, could be more kind of establishment for behaving, for the behavior of others that say try to accept egalitarian structures and so on.
Right. I think, I mean, any existing society already has a kind of normative order, so that people already sort of have expectations on how people should relate to them and so on. So that I think that talk of recognition is talk of existing realities, and all the societies that I know of have things to improve in all these respects. So that at the same time, it's an kind of critical normative theory. So it doesn't merely describe the existing orders, but somehow can be used as an immanent critique, so that there is some kind of commitment to, for example, mutual respect and justice, but this has been realized imperfectly so far. I mean, one just needs to think of global contexts, and I don't think that it would be a joke to say that global justice prevails, so that it's clearly, but nonetheless there seems to be a commitment that we should, you know, respect all human beings, so that it's a clear sort of clearly rooted in the existing normative order, and also a clearly critical idea.
So is the idea to bring recognition as a concept also into that normative order, that people have to recognize the others as others, for example, or is it an imminent critique? I mean, if it's an imminent critique on a normal practice, and people are doing this, they recognize the others or themselves as subjects or as persons, then you don't. Then there is no need for imminent critical theory on it. Only if you are criticizing the theory about the description or about the normativity, that is probably not enabling people to recognize.
I think the imminent critique can proceed in two ways. First, say that what is clearly and explicitly formulated principle or normative commitment, and then just point out aspects of the world where this is imperfectly realized. So that despite the commitment, I mean, often the commitments are not perfectly actualized, to put it this way. But then another way is that sometimes the understandings concerning the commitments or what follows from their commitments, they are also, not fully lucid and not fully explicit and so on. So that's another thing that what I would call immanent critique can do, that it sort of articulates the existing commitments in a better form. And then about whether we need the concept of recognition there or not, I think that's an open question. I mean, I would like to think that it's a useful conceptualization of what's going on, but that doesn't it doesn't matter that the people would use different concepts in their everyday life, but nonetheless the concept of recognition captures what they are talking about, for example, as in terms of honor or something like that.
Children, for example, because there was a discussion about struggling and struggle and recognition, but children they want to become autonomous, for example. So it's not the mother who has to who's responsible really in this relationship for how the child is developing, because something in what you can find in every child is like this idea of becoming independent. So there's not really a need between the mother and the child, that the child is struggling for this kind of independence, because it is like something given.
I think, I mean, there's also this saying that it takes a whole village to raise one child, in the sense that it's not only the primary caregiver and the child who is, growing up. But, I certainly believe that children do have this urge to basically become adults, and they also have an perhaps urge or desire not to grow up. That they have that there's something painful in growing up, and you know that there are sort of all sorts of pains and struggles involved, so that and people are torn in different ways. And also, there may be that parents might be sort of over protective and so on, and would not let go, and so that the fact that the child is becoming autonomous is not only a relief from all these parental duties, but it's also a loss of a very close dependency. So that there's a very complex dynamic involved there. But I would say that maybe that's it. Yeah. I was going to say something about the need to or desire to grow up, but I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ja, nach dem Gespräch mit Arto Lehtinen konnte ich mit Annemarie Eggert-Olsen sprechen. Und zwar hat sie auch an der Konferenz teilgenommen und hat einen Vortrag über The Concept of Theory in Critical Theory gehalten. Und sie unterrichtet an der Danish School of Education und ist Associate Professor am Institut für Pädagogische Philosophie. Ihre Schwerpunkte ist also die Geschichte der Philosophie, das Verhältnis von politischer Philosophie in der Geschichtsphilosophie, Platon und Aristoteles und antike oder auch mittelalterliche Philosophie und auch kritische Theorie. Und in dieses Gespräch werden wir jetzt auch gleich reinhören. Thank you.